But today is VE Day. The war is
the
over.
The crown queen waves from the Belt.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The worldwide web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.
Hello and welcome to The Wealth Show, where we discuss key topics shaping the wealth management industry and investor portfolios. Today in the Citywire studios, I'm joined by Dan Kemp, who is the founder of Portfolio Thinking and the ex-CEO of Morningstar, where you spent more than a decade guiding the firm's research and investment team. Dan, welcome to the show.
Grace, it is great to be with you.
So let's get into what we're focusing on today, which is by no surprise from me, a discussion on ETFs. So ETFs have been around for a long time. They just celebrated their 26th birthday in Europe this year, which means that they're slightly older than me, but around the same age. But over the last few years, the number of products has increased massively in the European market. And they've come into sort of mainstream fashion in the wealth management industry. There's ads for them on tubes. There's ads for them on trains. Finfluencers are recommending them to first-time investors. And new players are entering the market every week with their own sort of self-branded ETF products. As someone that's witnessed the evolution of this wrapper, what different perceptions have you seen from the wealth management industry when it comes to them?
Well, it's a really wide gulf. And I'm delighted to say I'm not quite as old as mutual funds, which I think started in 1931, which they were obviously the precursor and people's gateway into collective investing. And now we have ETFs taking center stage. And for many, that's been quite a challenging transition in the wealth space because platforms traditionally came out of the mutual fund space. And so people are used to trading mutual funds on platforms. They're not so used to trading ETFs. It's more difficult to do. Not all platforms, of course, accommodate ETFs. So if you're running model portfolios, managed portfolios across a range of platforms that you use as a wealth manager or that you provide for advisors, then it's difficult to use ETFs because they're not available on all. And even where they are available, sometimes they're expensive to trade, they're difficult to trade. And so there's a whole wide range of approaches that wealth managers are taking. Very different in the US. So I've looked after the team in the US as well, and over there, wealth managers, RIAs, as they're more typically known, they are very familiar with ETFs, and that's partly because the tax advantage is so much greater in the US. So a lot of the push we're seeing towards ETFs actually comes from a tax quirk in the US rather than the dominance of a desire to invest them in Europe.
Yeah, for sure. And so I think for some people as well in the industry, from what I've heard anyway, is that some people just say that they are just another wrapper and they're not, you know, as special as people think they are. What do you think about that? What have you heard from people?
So I think in this part of the world, that's absolutely true. It is a wrapper, but like all wrappers, it has benefits, it has drawbacks, it has quirks. And so people need to understand that because if you assume there's no difference from a mutual fund, a unit trust or OEIC, then you can get yourself in a bit of trouble. But yes, we should really think of them as just being another way of accessing a basket of assets. But as you mentioned at the beginning, that's where all of the really interesting product developments come from recently. And so you have much greater choice in the ETF world now.
Yeah, for sure. And I know that they are more suited to different sorts of things, which you can get into now for us. But could you tell us your recommendations when it comes to ETF investing? Perhaps for someone who knows what they are, is familiar with them, but isn't quite sure what purpose they can serve or what purposes they don't serve.
Yeah, absolutely. Or we could call these some do's and don'ts.
Yeah, some do's and don'ts.
Let's start with the do's. So the first thing is do use them to get a specific exposure to parts the market that look attractive from an asset allocation perspective. So we are often used to accessing large parts of the market, and particularly if you're an investor who prefers to own passive funds or as we call them, index tracking funds, then typically these in a mutual fund form have been quite broad in their exposure. So it might be the whole of the US or the whole of Europe, something of that nature. And so with ETFs, because there's been so many launches recently, a lot of them are very precise, then you can access much more granular exposure. And so you might want Korea, for example. You can get Korea in a mutual fund, but that's an example of where you could access something very specific, or a US sector, let's say consumer defensive stocks. So that's the first thing, that you can be much more specific in your allocation. And then secondly, you can deal with some of the benchmark quirks that we find in some of these broad benchmarks. And so a really good example at the moment is emerging markets, where, as you know, over the last couple of years, a small number of technology stocks that have really are really benefiting from the AI investment boom, they have come to dominate the emerging markets. So really now, if you're looking at the emerging markets for diversification benefits compared to the US, you're not really getting them if you're buying a broad market exposure. People would argue with me about that, but nevertheless, there are still big technology holdings within that. Whereas with ETFs, you can target much more specific parts of the market. So you could, let's say, invest in some LATAM ETFs in specific countries or other countries in Asia that are not so dominated by technology, and of course, Middle East as well.
So I know some people do use them for those sort of regional precision targets, because there's been lots of products recently that are sort of vying for that ex-US exposure. And I know there's also been, you were talking about emerging markets, and I know that with WisdomTree, they've just launched an ETF that is for true emerging markets. So that kind of avoids
that. True. That's a great moniker to add to something.
Yeah, because it's like you said, it avoids those sort of like really well more developed countries in that region and hits the ones that are actually like truly emerging. So like I said, the ex-US exposures there, you've seen lots of launches of those for this year. So yeah, those sort of regional targets are definitely something that is easier in that sort of wrapper. But I know you had a last point as well.
I do. I have a final do. this is specifically for people who want to reflect their values in their investments. And that is, do use ETFs if you're building, let's call it an ESG portfolio or a sustainable portfolio. And that really reflects that all of the interesting, all is too strong. Most of the interesting product development has happened in the ESG space in ETFs, because over the last decade or so, the emergence of ETFs has corresponded with the desire for more ESG-related holdings. And so when you put these two things together, you've had an explosion of very specific ESG strategies in ETFs. So we took the decision when I was at Morningstar that we couldn't launch an ESG portfolio in the UK without including ETFs, because the exposure you could get through ETFs was so much broader and more useful than you could get if you just limited yourself to open-end funds. So if you're an ESG-focused investor, then really ETFs are a very powerful tool for you to use.
Yeah, and how do you sort of see the trends happening with ESG investing? Is it still as popular as it might have once used to be?
So I don't think it's as popular, but that view is partly clouded by the rejection of ESG that we're seeing in the US.
Yeah.
And this will take us off on a bit of a tangent, but if you think about comparing ESG to conventional investing, then with ESG, you're naturally operating in a more constrained environment in whichever dimension of ESG you use. And of course, a constrained environment is unlikely to always deliver better returns than an unconstrained environment. And so I think we had a trend of people who were attracted to ESG because they like the values it espoused, but they also thought they could perpetually get better returns because that's what was happening in market trends. And really, that's that idea of having your cake and eat it is not really grounded in good investment theory. And so when people have to make a choice, then naturally some people will choose performance, some people will choose their values, and so that's going to reduce the overall demand. But I think we've still changed the entire market. People are thinking about how they can incorporate their values in a way that they weren't doing 15 years ago. So that's a huge step forward. There's still a lot of fantastic products out there, but it's just a smaller group than it was, let's say, a few years ago.
And so why does that suit the ETF wrapper more?
Well, it suits it because so much product development has happened within ETFs. So where people are launching new ESG funds over the last decade or so, they've tended to emphasize launching ETFs rather than traditional mutual funds. So if you look at the marketplace, you get so much more choice if you're able to use ETFs rather than just mutual funds.
And so maybe go on to some of your don'ts now as well.
Yes. So don'ts. So don't actually ties a little bit with the idea of ESG, the first don't driver,
right.
Because that is, don't use ETFs for thematic investing.
Right.
So thematic investing really is driven by a story, a narrative. And the problem is that by the time someone's launched a product to benefit from that story or that narrative, then it's pretty often been priced in to the value of the underlying assets. That's even if it's able to capture that narrative at all. And Morningstar have done some wonderful work, an old colleague of mine, Kenneth Lamont, on looking at thematic investing and how to identify themes. And so even if an ETF can capture that theme, then by the time it's got to you as an investor in a product, then I'm afraid that theme's probably fully priced in. Now, these themes, if they last long enough, tend to go in and out of fashion, so you can still get very attractively priced assets in a thematic fund, but it's normally when no one's talking about the theme anymore, when the theme is deeply unfashionable. And so that's a bit like some of the ESG funds we've seen, when stocks with very strong ESG credentials went from being very popular to being unpopular, suddenly you could get great returns by, or great expected returns, I should say, by investing in those funds. But we know that thematic investing tends not to suit people. They tend to buy in when it's popular and prices are high and sell out when it's unpopular and prices are low. And so don't use ETFs to express a theme unless that theme is deeply unpopular and the fund's been around for a while. So that's the first one. The second is don't use it to access illiquid assets. We've seen a lot of this over the last few years where people have tried to wrap illiquid securities in a liquid wrapper. And really, the two are not meant to go together. There's nothing wrong with illiquid assets, but just don't try to create a liquid strategy from them. You tend to get unintended outcomes, so particularly when you get big flows in and out of those funds.
Yeah, so what sort of illiquid assets have you seen that our ETFs are trying to target, but it's not really working?
Really good question. So private credit is the classic, and private equity even. We've seen some stakes in things like SpaceX, which of course is still a private company. It's going to apparently launch on public exchange later this year, but it's still a private company. And so if you're trying to own private equity or private debt in a liquid wrapper, then you end up with very odd outcomes because you can't invest and divest within the ETF as easily as you can with public securities. So what happens is the weights of those private assets move around beyond the desire of the investor. And so for a very concrete example, this is not to do with ETFs, but if people remember what happened with the Woodford funds, that's an example of what happens when you try to put an illiquid asset in a liquid wrapper.
Yeah, and I know that I've seen some sort of private equity ETFs kind of launched. And when you look at the fine print, these products actually don't invest in actual private equity. It's more kind of, they say, we invest in products that kind of replicate private equity. So it's not actually a private equity ETF. Mm. It's something that's kind of trying to replicate that. So it's because it's, like you say, it's not logically possible to invest in an illiquid asset with a liquid product. But yeah, so what's your third don't?
So the third don't is don't use it to trade.
Okay.
one of the reasons that people like ETFs is that they do trade when the exchange is open. So unlike a classic mutual fund where I put in my order, let's say just after 12 today, and it may not get executed until midday tomorrow. That's very slow. It feels very old-fashioned. With ETFs, you can trade moment by moment throughout the trading day. And that is incredibly dangerous because all good investment decisions are long-term decisions. And so if you have that temptation to change your mind constantly, then you're unlikely to make good returns. Remember that if you are a private investor, if you're a wealth manager, you have no benefit in speed, no advantage in speed. There are many trading shops around the world who are acting in milliseconds. We just can't do that in a wealth environment, in a private investor environment. And so you have no edge when it comes to speed. And so even though it's convenient to be able to trade when you want to, that's fine. But the thinking behind that should always be long-term in nature and not just a moment-by-moment change of direction.
So not impulsive, because I guess the temptation is kind of intensified by the notion of 24-hour trading as well.
Yes.
But even on the exchanges, some exchanges are open 24 hours. And I think, you know, that is potentially going to be happening worldwide. And yeah, I guess it's kind of encouraging a bit more for trading to happen even more. But then what happens overnight when half the world is asleep, and it provides some difficulties? So you're saying that they suit longer term allocations, essentially?
They do, absolutely. And just so don't confuse the convenience of trading for an obligation to make short term decisions.
Yeah.
Exactly right.
Okay, yeah. Sure. So I'd like to move our conversation onto the topic of active ETFs.
Yes.
In Europe, active ETF launches have officially outpaced passive equity ETF launches for the first time in 2025. And while active equities are leading the change, what are your opinions on the active versus passive debate when it comes to ETFs across asset classes like bonds and equities?
Yeah, I love active ETFs. I think that's the logical next step for the industry, that there's lots of benefits to the ETF structure. And so being able to apply that to an active portfolio makes a ton of sense. So again, slightly different in equities and bonds. So one of the great advantages in bonds is that a lot of bond indices are not really constructed very logically from an investor perspective. So in the same way that equity benchmarks, equity indexes tend to be weighted by the size of the company, and so they tend to reward success, then bond indexes tend to be weighted by the size of debt outstanding.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily a sign of success if you have a huge amount of debt outstanding. That's not necessarily the largest holding that you want in your portfolio. And so passive investing in bonds carries some disadvantages. So if you want an ETF, then having an active exposure to the bond market may be really beneficial. Now, of course, you've got to trade off those anomalies that you can exploit to potentially higher fees. So you always need to think on a post-fee basis when trying to compare investment opportunities. But they make a ton of sense with bond investing. And a lot of the growth that you were talking about that we've seen in the market, as you know, has come from bond launches more than equity launches so far.
Yeah. And so why is this better for investors to have a different approach to the sort of debt that they're exposed to? Because isn't that sort of high risk debt associated with a higher yield?
So it might be associated with a high yield, but these days the bond indices are so stratified that you're tending to access a particular part. So it might be a high quality part of the market, it might be a government bond part of the market, or as you say, that the high yield part. But within that, if you weight by the amount of debt outstanding, then you could end up with a not very successful company, which still has a reasonable credit rating, but an enormous amount of debt outstanding. So if that went wrong, that could go wrong in a hurry. And so a bond investor who's thinking longer term, is thinking more independently, has some advantages potentially. Not all of them exploitable, and not every manager has equal skill, but they have some advantages they can exploit versus the passive bond market. So if you like ETFs, actually having the ability to have active exposure rather than passive exposure is an advantage.
Great. Okay. Moving on to active equities, what are your sort of opinions on those?
Yes, well, this is a transparency issue primarily. and so one of the challenges with an ETF is that everyone knows exactly what's in it. And if you are an equity investment manager, then that has been seen as being a problem in the past. So there was a very famous case back in, I think it was the 80s or the early 90s, of the Fidelity Magellan Fund, which I think that was the biggest fund in the world at the time, where there were clones emerging, where people could just follow the manager's holdings and charge us a slightly lower fee and not have that detracted from the investors that were investing in Fidelity. And so Fidelity became far less transparent, understandably so.
Yeah.
And so since then, there's this been this perception that you need to reduce the transparency of your investing in equities to avoid that cloning. And also, of course, it can create trading anomalies. If everyone knows that you're likely to come and buy something, then the price can move, and that can cause a depleted returns. So, transparency. The problem with ETFs, totally transparent. Mutual funds, not so transparent. So that's where we've had this rise of semi-transparent ETFs, which really bring together that desire for some opacity from the fund managers with the need to be transparent to be an ETF.
So if you could just go into a bit more about how these sort of semi-transparent products work and what essentially what they are.
Yes, of course. So when we think about mutual funds, when you think about a mutual fund being semi-transparent, really it means you get to see the top 10 holdings and not much else. And so that's so people see that but miss potentially what's in the tail unless they've got a data source that goes right down into everything the fund owns, or they wait for the report and accounts. It's different with an ETF, as you said, because ETFs have to disclose their holdings. So the way that a semi-transparent ETF works is that they disclose their holdings, but on a quarterly basis, typically, rather than every day. Now, of course, that creates a problem because with ETFs, if you're buying in the market and the market makers have to hedge some of their own exposure as they're doing these transactions, then how do they do that if they don't know what's in the ETF? And that's where you will have a tracking basket. So something that looks like the holdings in the ETF isn't precisely the same, but has a low tracking error to what the ETF actually holds. And so that allows the market mechanism to operate, allows market makers to operate, and for you still to be able to buy and sell through the day, but the ETF doesn't have to disclose its holdings every day. So that's a really sort of neat idea that's come into this market to deal with that aspect of semi-transparent. So you do find out what all the holdings are, just not immediately.
Yeah. And so I know that's more attractive for asset managers who are kind of, you know, sort of trying to hide their active strategies and protect their alpha. But why is that an attractive point for investors?
Well, it's less attractive than knowing the entire portfolio. But in reality, when you're buying an actively managed fund, you're really buying the skill of the manager, not your view on the underlying basket of stocks. So actually, once you've decided which asset class you want to invest in, be it US equities or Taiwanese equities, then you're looking for a skillful manager at a reasonable price to run that for you, and you are essentially trusting in their skill to be able to deliver those returns. So you really don't need to know what every holding is. It's nice to know what every holding is. It's particularly important when you're scrutinizing the work of that manager to know what every holding is. But you can have that on a slight delay. That's fine. But when you're buying and selling that holding, you don't need to know what all the holdings are, because you are, as I say, trusting the skill of the manager.
And so what are these disclosure periods kind of stretched out to? Is it sort of tri-monthly or?
So normally just quarterly, every 3 months.
Okay.
And that's when you'll see the entire disclosure. And so that's useful, as I say, for making sure that the manager is doing what they say they're doing. Now, these days, compliance is pretty tight, risk management is pretty tight, and so they more than usually are doing what they say they're doing. It's still always worth, if you own an active manager, digging around the bottom of their stock list and finding out what they've got there right at the bottom.
Yeah.
What they're not necessarily talking about at the beginning of their conversation with you.
Yeah. Okay. So it requires to have a little bit of faith.
All active management requires a little bit of faith, a lot of analysis up front, and a little bit of faith when you're investing.
Yeah. Talk about semi-transparent. So they were one of the first people, because the rules have changed recently. I know some of the regulators, Ireland and now Luxembourg, have both changed to say that actually semi-transparency can now be a thing. Mm. And I know Fidelity have launched a duo of semi-transparent products. But these didn't actually take off in the US. So this sort of notion of protecting your sort of secret sauce, people didn't seem to like not being able to see what they were buying into, essentially, because as you say, the whole point of an ETF is to see what you're buying into. And you can, even if a weighting is 0.001%, you can still see that that's still on the holdings disclosures. Yeah, so this didn't take off in the US, but why is the case potentially different in Europe?
So I don't think it's necessarily different in Europe, but I think if you take a step back to why it didn't take off in the US, one of the reasons is that it's been a really tough market for active managers in the US. And so why would you buy an active ETF if we know that active managers never outperform? And so that actually will limit the amount of demand. Now, I think it's probably better to say that active ETFs or semi-transparent ETFs haven't taken off yet.
Yes.
Because if we move from a period where it's very difficult to outperform the benchmark to one where it's easier to outperform the benchmark, and I can hear people howling at their phones as they listen to this or as they watch this, saying there'll never be a time when active managers outperform. And yes, active managers naturally, because of fees and all the other things that we know, have a natural drag, but we go through cycles where it's easier for active managers to outperform and more difficult. And we've been through a long cycle where it's been very difficult, but now some of the market pricing is quite extreme. So as we look forward, potentially there's a much better opportunity for active managers to outperform. And then when we get into European markets and emerging markets, this is where active managers have had a much better track record over the last few years when they've really struggled in the US. So I think that lack of enthusiasm for semi-transparent ETFs may have more to do with lack of outperformance, but also the fact that the people who've been buying ETFs have traditionally been passive-focused investors. So it'll take a little while, I'm sure, but I think it's a really important step forward to allow people who like the ETF structure to be able to access good active managers in that semi-transparent way.
Yes, for sure. And I know that another point is that active ETFs also, because as you say, indices are kind of dominated by certain companies. And so these active products allow people to kind of pick and choose the stocks. Can you go into a bit more about that?
Yes, so exactly right. So take Taiwan is an excellent example. Very niche, but excellent. So you look at Taiwan, it's dominated by TSMC, the semiconductor manufacturer, which is a huge holding there. Well, you may want to access the other stocks in the Taiwanese market. You may see great opportunities in Taiwan outside TSMC. Well, they're an active ETF give you that exposure and give you Taiwan without TSMC. Now, that's not a view on TSMC or other stocks in Taiwan, but it just shows where you have a dominant sector, a dominant company, then an active strategy can help you to exclude things that you don't want to own and also overemphasize things that you do want to own. And again, that's been very difficult in the US, because when the largest few tech stocks have been dominating returns, then every active manager, almost every active manager, looks like a bit of an idiot, to be honest. But as I say, that tends to be cyclical. And so if we see a redress in the US, if we see a shifting in terms of what investors want, or even a stumble in that technology sector, then we might see active managers do much better. And in that scenario, I can see semi-transparent ETFs be much more flavorful of the month than they've been recently.
Sure. Okay, well, that's all we've got time for today on the topic. But thank you, Dan, so much for joining me today on The Wealth Show to discuss ETFs here at Citywire Studios.
Grace, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
But today is VE Day. The boys
the newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.